A decade ago, lovers of hip-hop and soul in Kansas City would gather on Sunday nights at a greasy downtown dive bar to listen to DJs and eat hot wings. MCs would spit rhymes, and pretty soon a breakdancing circle would form. Years later, some of those people, plus a whole new crew, have joined in on a similar event. But now it's in the afternoon, and it involves a lot more crayons. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. On today's show, Hip Hop Grows Up. Let's go with producer Sylvia Maria Gross to see what that's all about.
A block away from 39th Street in the Volcker neighborhood, I can already hear the music pouring out of the local pub Mo Brew. Windows are wide open on this warm, almost hot day. People are spilling out. It's Sunday, so I have my family in tow, which is all cool because this monthly DJ event has turned into a romper room.
You know, it's like if all the kids from your happy hour at your bar that all had kids and disappeared just all got together one day and brought the kids to the bar.
It's like this is the way to learn the culture. This is how the culture has been passed on forever.
That's Nisha Gambi. She's like everyone's mom. Always grooving with her long silver dreads, she knows a thing or two about raising up a scene. Her kids are grown now. She just had a grandchild. But when they were young, her house was the place where her children's friends all learned how to engineer sound.
There are a lot of hip-hop heads that have children, and they are really family-oriented, and they are bringing their children up in the hip-hop culture, and they want to share that culture with their children. And this is the place to do that.
Part of that culture is music, but also painting, dance, wordsmithing, and a philosophy. While we talk at a picnic table, Nisha and I watch a tiny breakdancer bouncing on the street corner.
So it's best learned in an informal manner with lots of support.
And now he's climbing an awesome 39th Street lamppost.
Yeah, exactly. And a minute ago he was coloring, you know, so...
Inside, DJ Ataxic is at the tables.
This has been, honestly, I can easily say this has been my favorite gig that I've ever had, ever.
Ataxic, otherwise known as Brian Fisk, started this party with DJ Jock Max about a year ago.
I think it was in June. Somebody had called me and said, hey, I know they serve food. You know, is it a restaurant? Can we bring kids? And I was like, you know what? Let me check.
Mo Brew was fine with it. And for Brian, who's been DJing in Kansas City for 15 years, it was a dream to be able to squeeze in a gig between church and dinner.
It's funny, this is what we call hip-hop and hot wings for old people. So it's different because, you know, that was such a great time period for music here in Kansas City. But, you know, we've all grown up. To be able to still be able to play music and enjoy each other's company along with the full family, it's amazing.
The last element to making it all work, though, came from graffiti artist Scribe.
My mom taught me at an early age that a kid that doesn't have anything to do is going to find a way to break something. And that's when all the art stuff started coming in. We started making the coloring pages.
Scribe's work is all over Midtown and downtown, murals of crazy animals. His real name? Donald Ross. He's now artist in residence at Children's Mercy Hospital. Doesn't that sound grown up? He knows as much as anyone how hard it is to pass your music on to your children.
That was a heartbeat behind everything I did during my building block years. And I want to be able to share that part of it with my kids.
Scribe says kids will listen if they can make memories around music. And that's what he hopes his boys, who are 9 and 12, are doing here.
Hey, Elijah, or Jonah.
Good.
Thomas McIntosh is DJ Jock Max, the other guy behind Soulful Sundays. His daughter is 17.
Our lives as selectors and DJs was always so separate from our families. And for a change, why not have something where it can be all-inclusive?
Even Jock's mom is here.
She really kind of engendered the spirit of being a DJ in me, like giving me her records and exposing me to music and taking me to buy records.
We used to go to Tigress Records.
Yeah.
You remember Tigress
yes,
Records?
On Independence Avenue.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was
always.
Kind of,
and now another generation will have these memories to pass on.
or reject.
Thanks to Sylvia Maria Gross for that report on family-style hip-hop in Midtown KC. I'm part of the hip-hop and Hot Wings generation, so I'm not surprised to hear that a lot of the regulars now have kids and do their hanging out as kind of a collective playdate. But what does hip-hop look like and feel like when it's no longer a youthful rebellion? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's Central Standard on KCUR explores hip-hop as an older man's game or an older woman's game, as the case may be, plus the difference between Kansas City's hip-hop scene a decade ago and now. Call 816-235-2888 if you've grown up with hip-hop, and tell us, is hip-hop growing up with you? Has your relationship with the scene matured in some important way? 816-235-2888. I want to start with Jock Max, a DJ we just met a moment ago at that afternoon hip-hop get-together. We have actually a lot of the characters we stumbled upon there in the studio today. Jock Max, good morning.
Good morning.
Since you're not DJing, can I call you Thomas?
Absolutely.
Tell me about your upbringing. I want to know, we just heard a little bit with you and your mom, but I want to know when and how you got into music.
It was very early. As early as I can remember, the photos that predate my memory kind of show that it was organic. Those were my toys.
What were your toys?
Records. At one, two. I was just always interested in sound. And so my mom, my dad, my older sisters really kind of encouraged that. And so would take their money and buy records that I chose for myself as a youth that I enjoyed. And one thing led to another. By the time I was nine, I had a pretty serious record collection.
What is, of the records in your collection now, what is the oldest one, do you know? Like something that you still play that, I mean.
Well, the oldest one is probably from a 78 from the 40s. I didn't necessarily buy that one, but it was handed down to me. But something that I still play that I remember getting as a child as a Mama's and Papa's LP that we went to buy together. I know, strange choice, but great tunes on the album. The Woodstock LP that I got as a child, handed down from my mom and my dad. And early George Clinton recordings that were all the rave for a kid in the late 70s. And so I still play those, but honestly, they need to be replaced because they're pretty worn out.
Because they were toys.
They were toys and yet entertainment at the same time.
But as a DJ, do you think of records as toys on some level or no?
Well, I think of them as tools now. My wife would call them my other children because because of how I pamper them and take care of them. But tools, but so much more than tools. Just food.
Like
almost.
Sustenance.
Yeah, I need them. Like,
what was it about hip-hop that really drew you in at some point?
Oh, the energy. Youthful expression. Initially, I was a below-average drummer.
How old were you? I mean, what time period in your life are we talking about?
Nine.
You're nine. Okay, you're a nine-year-old below average drummer?
Yes.
I'll take your word.
And I heard this new form of art where they were speaking more than actually singing. So not very melodic, but rhyming words. And I was just like, oh, wow. And the rhythms were things that I was familiar with. Soul rhythms, replayed, you know, funk records that were replayed for these guys to do these raps over and these like monologues over. And so I felt like, wow, you know, my uncles are cool enough. They used to say some of those same things, and I could say some of that too. But then I really liked the fact how they isolated my favorite part of the record, the break, the groove. And so it just, all of those things together combined just really piqued my interest, and I was locked in from that moment.
Would you say that, I mean, at that point, was hip-hop pretty new?
In this part of the country, yeah.
Tell me about that. I mean, does the Midwest have a different kind of relationship with hip-hop? Did it at that time?
It did. It was foreign. initially. I mean, because when you think about the word, you know, hip hop, you think about the form of music that it, that represents the culture, rap music. There were always raps on songs. Like Isaac Hayes has a song called Ike's Rap. You know, James Brown would say, "Let me rap to you for a second." And it really meant just, you know, talking. That's how my uncle and my dad would want to convey some information or some instruction to me. "Come here, son, let me rap to you for a minute." You know, so just really let me, you know, give you something. But in the sense of rap being the musical or the spoken word portion of hip hop, yeah, it was foreign and it was kind of like, what is this? You know, the Midwest was a little taken aback by it.
Did the feeling of being part of something new and cutting edge, and as you put it, foreign, did that kind of excite you?
Yeah, and no. I mean, it excited me because everything that I, you know, so many things that I liked about music, about soul, about rock, were all kind of converging in this one art form. But I was always sort of a homebody. So it just gave me one more thing to experiment with in my room. And so that was more exciting than actually going out and trying to find my tribe at that point, because it was so foreign, you know, so new in this part of the country, that those of us that eventually connected and found each other were finding our way. We're really figuring it out in our little laboratories, our bedrooms. So the excitement came of really just like, what is this and what are the inner workings of it? And how can I understand it better?
So, I love the idea of the little hip-hop kid in his room, that's a laboratory. We'll hear what's changed and what hasn't in a minute, but first let's get the backstory of one of our other guests, Scribe, a.k.a. Donald Ross. He's a graffiti artist, or at least he was. Scribe, do you still call yourself a graffiti artist? Is that still a title that you identify with?
Not really. I think that's changed. I've tried to figure out other kinds of words, like to put on it, whether it be street artist or mural artist, or but the truth is that I don't go out and paint illegally anymore, and I don't think it would be, I think it'd be insulting to other people that are still risking their freedoms for their art form for me to call myself a graffiti artist, but
like a graffiti artist emeritus. Like the title professors take when they're not in the classroom anymore.
I think I'm just good with spray paint, and that's even questionable. That's my history, and that was my art education.
I'm
really proud of that.
Yeah, how would you describe your personal hip hop journey? I mean, we just heard Jock Max's just from the beginning, like where it started for you.
I found graffiti in Boston before I moved to Kansas City, and it was when I was taking the subways to school every day, and it kind of like Thomas finding the music and curious about what it was and wanting to learn more. I found myself deciding not to go to school on a day and jumping fences and wanting to just go look at it and see what it was, because I was a cartoonist before I got interested in graffiti, and this just looked like an extension of it. There were people painting cartoon characters with these lettering, and it was almost like a puzzle that I needed to figure out. I learned a little bit about it. I saw Wild Style, and I had an artist.
What's Wild Style?
It's just an old movie. I'm horrible with dates, but just a movie that kind of like shows about all the different parts of the culture. That came together. I had an artist.
The hip hop culture. So
I had an artist named Bandit in an animation class that shared it with me, and that was when I started to understand a little bit more about the history. But I didn't really understand my part or piece in it. I was honestly only interested mainly in the graffiti part and the music. It wasn't I moved to Kansas City that I found myself wanting to absorb more of the history.
Speaking of all of that, I mean, you obviously participate as a visual artist, but there are, what, 5 elements of hip-hop. Can you kind of talk about how those go together, what they are, and what, like, the bigger picture is?
I get nervous about being involved in those definitions. There's so many more people that would be more knowledgeable than I would.
We're just talking the very basics for the uninitiated.
I mean, honestly, I'm mainly just concerned about the four that I started with, and that was the emceeing, the DJing, the breakdancing, and the graffiti. And that was how I grew up. I don't really pay attention, honestly, to the other elements of it that much anymore.
Well, so we'll get back to that, but you spent time like jumping fences and skipping school as part of your formation. How big a part of it was rebellion initially?
I never really saw it as like I was out on a mission to be rebellious against the system. It was about wanting more of, I never saw like anybody that I was being rebellious against. It was about me wanting to do more creative work. I went out and
asked. You were just so passionate.
I was just passionate about the art form. I wasn't really concerned about the effects. I just wanted to go out and paint with my friends. And I met other artists, and it was about us challenging each other. But there wasn't anybody that I was really concerned about, you know, like being rebellious against. I think that the term rebellious the rebelliousness that is perceived with it is really from people looking from the outside in. And I think that there's a lot of people that choose to do it because they're concerned about the creativity, not because they're on a mission to rebel against anything.
That there are certain aspects of being, excuse me, a street artist, as you put it, a graffiti artist, that do age in kind of a particular way for the person who is growing up and getting older and maybe becoming quote unquote legit in society or whatever, like however you choose to put that. Mm-hmm. But I once interviewed Shepard Fairey. He's famous for creating prints that he'd affix to the surfaces of mm-hmm. buildings or bridges or whatever in the dark of night. And even people who aren't into hip hop probably are familiar with his work, whether they realize it or not. He did those Barack Obama Hope and Change prints that were such a big part of the 2008 campaign. But back in 2004, he came to Kansas City. He'd been invited to town to speak with the Art Institute, and he had promised not to do any illegal wheat pasting. But the students who came to his talk showed up with wheat paste and climbing equipment, and he didn't want to let them down. So he ended up putting up his images in the West Bottoms and the Crossroads. And he ended up getting in a whole lot of trouble for it. When I talked to him about that, he told me how hard it was to transition from a career of like kind of resisting the man to basically being the man. Plus, his back and knees were starting to hurt every time he scaled a building. Can you relate to any of that?
I can relate to that. I think that admitting that your priorities are changing is one of the hard things is to when you start realizing that. You know, you have to admit that when I started transitioning, I ended up having different priorities in my life, and I ended up having to decide which one was more important. Was it, you know, like continuing to do a form of hip hop that at first I thought like had this no rules and like there was no boundaries and stuff. And then I found out that there was rules within that system, and that stuff started to bother me a little bit. Like, what if I did want to grow in another direction?
What were the rules within the system?
Well, I can only speak on the graffiti world, but for me, when I first got involved in it, it was sort of advertised as like that there wasn't any. But I started meeting challenges that like by mainly doing characters, I wasn't really doing graffiti because some people only think that tags are graffiti and then other people only think it's tags.
You're just throwing up your name.
Yeah,
or
just throwing up your name
initials.
And then other people do their bubble letters of that stuff and they call that tags and throw ups. And then there's a whole nother one that says that it should all be like wild style pieces.
And we should say your work is very character driven.
It always has been.
A narrative.
But I just, the more I saw that argument going on amongst themselves, the more I started realizing that for me, a big part of hip hop was about carving your own path. And so when I first started doing graffiti and I was doing characters, I was trying to paint B-boys and I was drawing scenes of trains in my sketchbook. And then it just dawned on me that I had moved from Boston to Kansas City and there was none of that there. So what am I doing? I'm just emulating like an older like part of the culture that I respect and it's part of my history. But that's not the part of hip hop that I'm in. I'm in a Midwestern version of it. And I also like reconnected with my initial interests were animals and doing cartoons. And if part of hip hop is keeping it real and keeping it real with yourself and being yourself, then I had to figure out how to marry those two things together.
I once saw some of your work that you referred to the characters as biblical superheroes, like some biblical stories had made their way into your work as well. And I thought that was really interesting.
My dad's a pastor of a church in the Boston area. And so that's how I grew up. And so those stories of things like David and Goliath or the story of Jonah, those things started making their way into it. I don't want to like hide my past or hide my faith, but I'm also not really into beating people over the head with it. So I've started figuring out ways to reinterpret it and just like hip hop to have hip hop in some of the artwork that I do currently at Children's Mercy, that style has made its way into there, that there's this gentle heartbeat of like biblical stories and hip hop and everything interwoven because all those elements are what made me who I am today.
Jock Max Thomas, what's different about hip hop for you at this stage in your life?
What I choose to play, what I choose to embrace, what I choose to promote by my set list and what I'm really into. In times past, it was more rap record driven. You know, I wanted to play the hottest, newest, most avant-garde hip hop song that I could find. But as I've grown, become a dad, my relationship with the messages that have been put out and that are being put out have changed. I decided that I didn't necessarily agree with a lot of the things that were being said anymore and that I had changed.
What kinds of things?
Well, just a lot of misogynistic views, a lot of, aggression, violent speak. Those sort of things were no longer okay for me to play. It troubled my spirit, and I was not able to justify playing it. And so at that point, I had to step back and take a serious look at, okay, I know this is the platform on which I stand, and this is how I address the world with my art, but how can I interpret hip-hop in a way that is suitable to me? And so I had to make some changes artistically by what I chose to play.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from Kansas City's mother of hip-hop, Nisha Gambi, for a more long-term perspective. She is laughing at me for calling her that. And from you, what's your personal hip-hop story? It's all part of an episode we're calling Hip Hop Grows Up. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman here with DJ Jock Max, or Thomas for our purposes, and a one-time graffiti artist who's now searching for his title in some ways. He goes by Scribe, and in the daylight, he is Donald Ross. On today's Central Standard, we're talking about hip-hop culture and how it's aging with us. Or is it? 816-235-2888 with your personal story. Now I'd like to turn to someone who a lot of people would say maybe gets the definitive word on this subject here in Kansas City. She doesn't think so. She's shaking her head no vigorously. But if you have hovered anywhere near Kansas City's hip-hop scene, you know who she is. Her name is Nisha Gambi, and she's considered a matriarch in the scene. Hi, Nisha. It's a real honor to have you. In a past life, I served you coffee.
You did?
Yeah.
Where?
Over on 39th Street.
I love it.
How did you get into hip-hop?
Well, I don't think I had a choice. My children were into the music and were artists, are artists, and had lots of friends who were into the music and art. And there it was. It was in my house along with jazz because my mom was a jazz pianist.
But what did you think of it? I mean, because a lot of first of all, what time period are we talking about?
Oh, my. Probably 92. 91, 90s, in there.
So you probably were seeing your sons come home with a lot of CDs with that little sticker that said parental advisory.
Oh, I have
stuff
a story
like that.
For that one. Yeah. Yes, I was seeing that. And my son was frustrated by that. The one that for years was an MC, he was frustrated by the restriction. And so he gave me a lesson.
What was that lesson like?
Well, it was a stack of CDs sitting in front of my stereo at 2 o'clock in the morning and him telling me what's East Coast, what's West Coast, what's in between, why this, why that, why he loved this, why he, you know, wanted to know more about this. And I wrote him a note that he took up to Sound Warehouse that they kept on file that said he has my permission to buy anything in that store he wants.
But see, you say you had no choice, but I think I'm probably about the same vintage as your son. And I remember lots of parents not responding with that kind of embrace, just in general.
Well, you know, I'm inside my own household and my own environment. Yeah. And I grew up with the artists and around musicians and singers and dancers and all that. So that seemed the right way to go. It felt natural to me. I'm not a restrictive person in that way. It's creativity. And, you know, you never know where it's going to go, so you just allow it.
In that lesson your son gave you, what stood out to you about this culture, this genre, that you could connect with?
I'm going to say this. I'm 62 years old, and I've heard a lot of music in my life. And, I mean, been there when it broke, been there when how it breathed, and saw it leave. And what I can tell you is, it's hip-hop is the next it's the continuation. It's not, okay, I'll do it like this. Recycle, renew, reuse was a big deal. 80s, 90s, they were coming into that thought.
Yeah.
What I think about hip-hop and what I saw happening with my children is they were taking my records. They were recycling that concept, sound, feeling, and they were renewing it in a way that was meaningful for them. You know,
kind recycle, of maximizing the use
and
out
reusing
of it.
Everything that went before it. So to me, it was a continuation. It wasn't new. It was a reinterpretation and a moving forward. Because what I heard was djembe drum from Africa. What I heard was funk soul. What I heard was, you know, crooning. What I heard was soulfulness and a message. Okay. And dance has always been a part of our culture. It's like all of these things.
When you say our culture, what do you mean?
I mean Black culture, you know, because to me, even though hip hop is worldwide and I love that about it, it's like to me, this was generated in some ways, like a lot of Black music is, in despair, you know, in response to, I'm not going to be, you can't push me down. I'm going to rise. I'm going to rejoice. I'm going to be happy. No matter what my environment looks like.
So other than writing this letter to Sound Warehouse on behalf of your son,
yeah,
so that he could buy whatever CDs, how else did you support and foster what you saw as like a really positive connection with culture, with music?
Well, I have to say that my mom and I both are nurturers. So our house, which is two apartments, big, was like this place where my kids and their friends could be free. Sort of. Because, you know, I'm a mom. And so there were limits, but more than limits, there was a freedom to just do creativity, be okay. And so one of the other things I saw was I would come home and my stereo would be missing. It would be in under some bed or in a closet. There would be people under beds and in closets, in the shower. Because this is where my oldest son started learning how to record.
Oh, so they were seeking quiet spaces to work with sound.
Because a lot of the guys were MCs or exploring that. Or beat making.
Can you explain? So these distinctions like MC versus DJ, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Earliest version of MC would be the guy who's rocking the party with the DJ. All right. But it evolved to like being a verbal news casting of whatever was going, a perspective, what's going on in life, what's happening in my life, what am I feeling, what am I learning. So MC, beat maker, producer, any of those kind of words, is the person who makes the music, you know, and samples and finds sounds and merges those sounds into something that an MC would rhyme over, you know. So all that was happening in my house. It's pretty wild, actually, when I think about it.
Do you, so, but you look, when I refer to you as a matriarch of hip-hop in Kansas City, and I say that because, I mean, my relationship with that scene has been very, very peripheral, but anytime I've been around it, like, you're someone I see, and you're someone who I can tell people recognize and feel really safe around, and that you have this sort of soft leadership role that is maybe informal, but I think it's very... just it's obvious in a heartbeat. And so you don't accept the title of matriarch, or do you?
Well, first off, I have issues with the word matriarch anyway, especially as applied in Black culture and in feminism. I just can't. We won't even go there. But
I kind of want to, but
no.
Okay.
Don't go there. Okay. So, okay. Here it is. At some point, yes, I've been someone's parent and I've raised some children and I've fostered some creativity, but I love this culture. I love this music. I love these people in it. They're my family. I'm one of them. I'm not their mom. I'm a lover of this culture.
You're just a part of it like everyone else.
Everybody else. It's like, but it's okay if people want to attribute my gray hair and the fact that I'm older and use that as a solidifying force, or I allow it. But in my heart, I'm just one of them. These are my people.
Talk to me more about what this culture on the whole means to you. I mean, you didn't come to it as a kid trying to carve out an identity, to trying to find a group of friends. So when you dig deeper, what's in it for you?
Well, the first thing that's in it for me is the fact that my children bless me in. I know there's a generational gap. There's a thing that happens to a lot of parents and their children where they no longer can relate. And I felt really blessed that my children and their friends love me enough to teach me and invite me in. When my children started making music and creating their methods of creativity, I was their merch madam for their shows. I sat in the middle of a breakdance circle cipher. I, you know, invited 8 DJs to get down together. I love these people. They're my family, you know? So it's like,
so that's a lot about the people.
Well, that isn't anything. Isn't it all about the people? I mean, you know, and it's like the culture that I've had questions in my head about what the culture is. And what I figured out is that every person gets to decide that for themselves. And that there are places where we intersect and agree. And there'll be places where we don't and where we share with each other our perspective. And that'll help it be bigger, richer, different, whatever. And that's cool. I like being a part of that growing process. And I really think that this culture and these people have inspired me greatly. And they keep me young.
Yeah. I want to hear about that same idea from our other guests. I mean, Thomas, for you, what does hip hop culture mean to you as an adult now that you're, you know, like a generation of your life into it? You've gone through many phases of your life, childhood, your teen years, your early adulthood, and now your full on adulthood.
Freedom of expression, the ability to expose people to things that they didn't know existed. I've always enjoyed the aspect of hip hop, and I'm speaking from the artistic aspect of it, the DJ, the production side of it, to where we can take things that were forgotten and use them again and actually make people want to know about the source. as opposed to about just this new piece of art where we used a sample. I was speaking with a gentleman yesterday, and he was saying he learned about jazz from Q-Tip, from A Tribe Called Quest, sampling, you know, Freddie Hubbard records and so on and so forth. And it just moved him to want to learn, okay, who's Freddie Hubbard? Now, who's the drummer on this Freddie Hubbard record? Oh, he sampled this. What is this? Who's Weldon Irvine? To me, it means an education. I always, and it's important to me now because when Nisha said that generational gap, I strive every day to not have that gap between my daughter and myself. She turns me on to new music, but it, at the same time, I turn her on to things. She'll say, listen to this record, and I'll say, oh, that's great, but that's really just this. They sourced this. And then she'll now have to go back and say, oh, wow, I can see how influential that piece of music was. So it's an education.
And then she can be cool with her friends being like, whatever, guys, you know where that comes from.
Yeah, listen to where this comes from. Or she can come home and say, Dad, I really love Steve Arrington's voice. I don't think he can sing that well, but I love what he uses and, you know, how he uses what he has. And I'll say, well, go downstairs and get all of Slave's records and get into them. You know, so it's just a constant education. It's discovery. And I've always loved that.
But speaking of continuity, I mean, do you think that the next generation is experiencing hip hop in ways that are different from how you did, that are significant and need to be understood?
I think they're experiencing it in ways that were different, in the sense that we were immersed in a culture when we first learned about it. Breakdancing, graffiti, DJing, MCing. Now it's so commercialized that people experience one aspect of it primarily, and that's rap music. And I really feel like they're missing out. And so their interpretation is based off of one thing as opposed of four providing one. And so I think that needs to be addressed. It's so much wider in scope.
And Scribe, what, Donald, what about you? I mean, does anything either excite you or concern you about a new direction?
I guess really to expand a little bit more on what Thomas was saying, but from an artistic standpoint about the younger parts of hip hop. To use an example, when I was younger and there was only so much spray paint available, we would get tips off of tiny Krylon cans, tester cans from Hobby Lobby in order to get the stuff that made lines finer. We would take off caps from auto parts places in order to have a fat cap, which paints a really big one. And everything was like an adventure about how to find the pieces and how to make something out of nothing. Now that I have kids, I see this parallel between, like, I've been blessed with a certain amount of success, which means that I can give things to my kids faster. Sometimes the negative side of that is that they don't understand all of the hard work that it takes in order to achieve those things. And I think that hip hop in some ways is consuming things at a faster rate. And so the people aren't digging for the records and trying to find the breaks in the stores. And there's like so much like emotional love involved in the journey in order to get there.
It's like going to the store for something now, to eat instead of going out and hunting it or something.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of times where we end up saying like, That child is unappreciative because it was all given to them, and that offspring sometimes creates a brat, and so that, you know.
So are you saying there's like maybe a hip hop brat?
I've seen a couple nods in here, and I'd say yes, because now as a parent, that's why I was trying to draw that parallel, that like I've made that mistake with my children by making things almost too accessible and too easy.
Let's hear from Danny in the Northland. Hi, Danny. What can you add?
Hey, how's it going? I grew up in what people would call the hip hop community, you know, kind of I'm originally from Raytown, and then we moved up to Liberty, and, you know, it was such a culture shock for me moving up to Liberty because, you know, the demographic and the diversity and everything. And, you know, I was a fan of all hip hop, but now it's gotten to the point where some of it's gotten so vulgar that, you know, I don't really want my kids listening to some of it, but I do think that some of the older hip-hop that I grew up on is definitely essential for them to listen to and to be exposed. That way they can get a wide variety of music.
I wonder if this is particular to hip-hop or if this is part of a parent's journey just more generally, that what's of the next generation feels vulgar. I mean, definitely early hip-hop to some of the previous generation felt vulgar. Nisha doesn't agree.
You know, it's part of this is owed to our culture, our larger culture, and how it consumes and what it wants. And I would say to you that what this culture wants to consume is a particular point of view, a particular idealized idea of what hip hop is or what black culture is or what's cool, what's not. And it's not always going down a good path. You know, and I could talk at length about words that are said, but you'd have to bleep them.
And therein, which we can't do live.
Well, but therein lies the problem. Mm-hmm. You understand? It's like, it's not
that
just...
That we can't even talk about the problem.
It's not even that they're just... Okay, now I feel like I'm on my high horse, first, number one. But it's not just that they're using language. They're also painting whole scenarios and pictures of what life is within a certain culture and demographic. And they're, you know, acting like that's cool. And they're also, at the same time, painting scenarios that are unattainable for most of the people who consume, either is attainable or is unattainable based on where the people are consuming it.
So if you, it sounds like there's some other core idea from hip hop that you would rather see, like, children taking on and growing up within and internalizing, you know, from maybe a previous generation of hip-hop. What would you say that is?
Can I continue?
Oh, sorry, yes.
Because that's the antithesis, is exactly that. What I liked about hip-hop when my children were doing this, that it inspired individuality, creativity, exploration, you know, community, in a sense, a way of fighting without fighting, words, verbal, dancing. Because it's a dialogue. That's all dialogue. It's like when you have a gun. You know? Anyway, it's like
when you have a gun?
Well, as opposed to a knife or your fist. You know, if you have fists, it's okay. You can punch each other, get a black eye, and recover and hug and say it's cool. You use a gun, it's over.
I'm Gina Kaufman, your host for Central Standard on KCUR. We're going to take one last break this morning. We'll be right back to this conversation about how hip-hop has changed in Kansas City in our own personal lives, and maybe some defining moments and shared memories for Kansas City's hip-hop scene. We'll be right back.
And now the new school is no school, because everybody and their mama knows Pro Tools.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. Our show today has been all about what it's like for the hip-hop generation to grow up with DJ Jock Max, or Thomas, and Scribe, a.k.a. Donald, as well as Nisha Gambi, who has been in the scene for a long time as well. We'll stick with that crew, but now let's look back a little bit. Guys, I'm curious about the moments and people who really established what hip-hop would feel like and be like in Kansas City. I mean, I know some of those people are right here in this room, but who and what would you point to if you were looking back on sort of those early days when people were finding each other and laying the foundation for what we call the hip-hop scene now?
For me, I think it was the early, like when I moved here in 93 and hooking up with a group called Flavor Pack that did an underground magazine, and they threw warehouse parties. And
warehouse parties where?
Down in the Crossroads area before it was filled up and there were empty space. A guy named Jeremy McConnell, Tommy Lift, and my old buddy Gear, and a whole group of them just started bringing DJs and MCs and breakers and stuff together. And witnessing that, I felt like I was lucky to witness something that I did learn about in the history of New York. And what I did see was a lot of people from different culture. They at the beginning, they brought in bands that were like more punk, and then they had a DJ. And that reminded me of like what I saw in some of the history films. And I thought that they did a good job of me being allowed to be exposed to that. And the benefit that came out of that was I am an introverted and quiet person. I still am. But hip hop taught me how to learn how to be more extroverted. And it taught me about a confidence that I didn't know was there.
Just how to talk to other people.
How to put myself out there and share my art form and to be comfortable with that. A lot of it was on my back and I had to do it on my own, but I had a support system of people that were cheering me on along the way and people that were pushing themselves and DJing and MCing on the same level. And I wanted to match their level of intensity, but through my art form.
Thomas, what about you? When you look back on, like, what are some of the crucial moments, like regular events, things like that? I remember some that involved you from when I first moved back to Kansas City after leaving for school for a while. Came back and there were some dance events, I would say, at Harling's, at Polly's, that's most recently Coda.
Yeah, those were big. To me, those were huge moments in the sense of actually taking the musical aspect of hip-hop back to its roots, as opposed to just playing rap records. We played funk, soul, breaks, jazz, jazz fusion. And at its root, that's what hip-hop music is.
And these were dance parties. These were sweaty affairs.
Yes, people actually really letting it go to the source of everybody's favorite rap records. And to me, that was an epiphany to me. Like, I can really play what I grew up on. When I was listening to music and finding my way, for a while there were no rap records. It was only those records, and eventually rap records came along later, but I always had a heart for those original breaks. And so those parties were huge, but I look back at my formative years, Robert Harris and the Knights of the Turntable, Captain Von Zell, LS Flash, QT and LA the DJ, DJ Fresh.
Who are these people? I mean, I know you can't give us all of their biographies, but like looking at them sort of collectively, maybe, like what was that?
Forerunners of the music culture in this city. People who really stepped out and laid it on the line, you know, playing records, scratching records. Even for a period of time, just scratching records was abrasive to the public. Like, what is that noise? What are you doing? You know, this part of the country had never heard a DJ extending an 8-bar break to 2 minutes, and they just didn't get it. It was new.
Is it just me, or do you think that the hip-hop scene in Kansas City is very maybe like funk and soul influenced in a way that is, I don't know, maybe a little bit distinctive?
Yes, it is, because we're a jazz town. To me, funk is beefed up jazz, and so we have an affinity for funk, for soul, that, you know, is unique to us. And plus, the Midwest put out, you know, the best funk and soul records came from this part of the country. I'm speaking 60s and 70s. This is where it came from. So it's natural for us to be driven towards that.
Nisha is agreeing.
Oh, I'm just loving this. Lord, have mercy, really. Just hearing them talk about these things, I relate maybe from a different perspective because I was probably much older than them but I love hearing that they're going back and bringing forward. One thing that comes to mind is Babies Making Babies, which is something that Questlove did a tour of where he took music from former times.
Nisha Gambi, this has been so great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Donald Ross, a.k.a. Scribe, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Jock Max, thank you.
My pleasure.
We'll have audio from today's show ready at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. And if I sound a little choked up, it's because I have something I need to tell you. I'm about to go on maternity leave. This is actually my last show for a little while, so I'm excited about this upcoming adventure. Even the parts that are a little bit terrifying, and I feel unspeakably lucky to be embarking on parenthood with my husband, KCUR's health reporter Alex Smith. I'll be picking right back up where I left off in the fall, which is when I will jump right back into this seat. Until then, keep listening. You are in good hands with the brilliant producers who have kept Central Standard humming along behind the scenes. They will keep right on doing what they do without missing a beat. Brian Ellison and a few other really nice people will handle all the interviewing so that I can spend time with my baby. I can't thank them enough. Have a great summer, everyone. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.